Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hello, and thanks for joining the Global Marketing Podcast. Today, we welcome Dave Shepherd of MedWorld Advisors, and he's going to be fascinating because he's done business on every continent in the world except Antarctica. How many people in the world do you think can make that claim, Dave?
You know, I do not know, but I'm guessing it's a smaller group of people that have a lot of gray hair like me.
I mean, the experiences that you must have and the stories, I'm really looking forward to this. So welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to spend time with you, Wendy. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So what was your favorite country to do business in?
I have to tell you, I have many favorites and for different reasons. And it seems like a lot of it seems to come down to food. So that tells you something about me.
That's great. So what are your favorites?
So one of my favorites is Singapore, because I've done a lot of travel in Asia with China and India and other countries. And while there is good food there, it's a little bit different. You can only take so much of it for so long. So when you go to Singapore after going to those countries, and the food is the best of the West, right? So they do everything we do in Europe or US. However, they just do it a little bit better, and it's really awesome.
Oh, that's great to know. So they probably have foods from all over the world.
They really do. In Singapore, it's a melting pot, really, of people from international around the world. They have the British history. There's been some American influence, but a lot of Chinese influence. However, they actually do Chinese a little cleaner, a little safer, and a little better. And the same thing with the Indian food as well. So I could probably spend 2 or 3 weeks there just having a different meal each day and never being, always looking for more.
Okay, so it's like a real Epcot then. Because Epcot, yes, you still travel the world, but Singapore, you're really doing it.
that's right. And it's a very clean city, and it's a very, very safe city. So it's one of the few countries in the world where you had your teenage daughter, that you actually would be okay if she was out at 2 a.m. You would not worry about her.
So is it true you can't chew gum there?
That part is true. So you have, it does, everything comes with its compromises. Every country has its pros and its cons. So they do have a few rules there. So you do have to honor those rules. However, it's for me as a visitor, it's worth it. Now, if I was living there, maybe you might have a few different challenges with some of the rules. However, they've seemed to have been very prosperous over the last 50 years. So it does seem to be working for them.
Right. It's funny. You can't have gum there, but we were in London and there's a bridge there that has gum stuck on it. And there's an artist that goes there and paints on it. So if you don't know, I think it's the Millennium Bridge. If you don't know how to look for it, you'd never notice it. But a friend of ours told us about it. So we were kind of crawling across the bridge to look at the different artwork.
No, that's great. And there's a bridge in Paris, maybe you've heard of, where the couples, because, you know, Paris is a romantic city, and couples put locks on the bridge. And so it starts to really look nice after a while, but sometimes there's so many of them, they have to try to go and take some of them out. There's too much. But the idea is that the idea of the romantic city, that people are locking their love together on this bridge in Paris.
You know, I've seen pictures of that, and I never knew what the backstory was for it. So now, yeah, I have another excuse to go back to Paris to see that.
Yeah, the good news for me, the co-founder of MedWorld Advisors, she's originally from Paris. So I have a lot of inside information on Paris, which is helpful.
Oh, that's great. All right. So Singapore is probably right up there on one of the top places to do business. What about one of the hardest places to do business?
I would have to say, well, it's an easy answer, it's an accurate answer, is China. The main reason for that is that the rules keep changing in China. And I think, Wendy, you know, as somebody who's experienced in business and trying to be able to follow procedures and regulations to be able to get things done for your clients, you can live with the rules. Whatever the rules might be, they may be challenging, if you know what they are, you can work with it and you can make a plan. The challenge is when the rules keep changing midstream, then it's very difficult to work with those rules. And China, over the last 20 years, started as someplace that was relatively easy to work with relative to the regulatory environment to bring new products into China, because essentially they wanted new products. They wanted Western innovation from Europe, from the US. And then they started to realize that they could make money off of being a regulatory agency in China. And they could also gain a little inside information, to be candid, in China by how they ask questions about innovation. And so they started changing the rules. And they've changed the name even of the Tinder rules so much, they've changed the name of the regulatory body in China several times, you know, from the Chinese FDA to the NMPA and a couple of other names along the way. And I've literally been in China because I have good friends who are CEOs of companies in China. And I've asked them, even as recent as last year and before COVID, when I could travel there, in this case, if we were to bring this product to China, you know, are they going to require a clinical trial or not? And even somebody who's very experienced in the Chinese market for 20 years, lives in China, CEO of a company, started another company and took it public, and still that person still wasn't even sure what the rules were even 1 year ago.
Wow. Okay, so let's step back a little bit and define what you do, and then I want to drive into how you're advising clients to do that. So you've been in M&A, business development, you've launched companies in new markets, you've worked in big companies, small companies. Tell us about what MedWorld Advisors does.
Yeah, Wendy, thank you for asking that. So I've had a long, extensive career, as we talked about early on, working in multinational companies. I came up through the commercial side of the business in medical device, med tech. I mean, going from in-hospital sales, selling products to surgeons, and then running global business groups for Tyco International, which then became Tyco Healthcare, and Tyco Healthcare became Covidien, and now Covidien's part of Medtronic. So through that experience, not only did I learn how to launch products internationally around the world, but we did a lot of acquisitions at Tyco. You may remember the days of Dennis Kozlowski. Dennis Kozlowski was the CEO of Tyco, who was trying to make Tyco into the next GE. I remember Jack Welch back in the day had all this press, and so Dennis Kozlowski wanted to be the next Jack Welch, and he had a lot of press in New York media about, is he the next Jack, that sort of thing. So he knew that Jack Welch grew GE by acquisition. So he wanted us all to go out and make acquisitions, so much so that in some cases they weren't necessarily that strategic. They just needed to be accretive, meaning be net positive on the balance sheet for the acquisition.
So basically, buy companies to make our revenue go up.
Just to make the company bigger, right?
Make it bigger.
And, yeah. And then he about buried the company when he bought a financial company called CIT Financial, which was, I think, for about approximately $16 billion around 2001, 2002 timeframe, because he was trying to emulate GE again, because GE had his financial arm, right? And he ended up selling the CIT Financial for about $4 billion one year later, so lost $12 billion, and he almost buried Tyco in the process.
Wow.
And so he just got carried away with his own ambition, and also not only in terms of the corporate initiatives, but also in his personal initiatives. Ultimately, the tax man got him in New York.
That's what I remember about him.
Yeah. And so we were grateful that whatever it took to get him out, because it was actually the tax man going after some art paintings in his New York Manhattan office that I think he flew into New Hampshire, where there was no tax, and then he drove it across the border to be able to avoid New York taxes. And the tax guy got him. That's why he ended up in jail. And then fortunately, we got
hearing about the parties he had too.
Right. Yes. A very elaborate things in Greece and things I was not that high up to be at those parties, and I think that was a good thing.
Yes, that was. So you were high enough up to be flying all over the world and making the acquisitions and doing the business, but not getting into trouble. That's good.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so from that experience, you launched MedWorld Advisors after that?
Yeah, so when I left eventually Covidien before it came Medtronic, I started consulting with smaller companies to take the corporate knowledge that I learned over at that point 30 years in the industry, and just start working with smaller companies. So I have really a passion for innovation, and that was one of the things that I started to become frustrated with at the big company is the pace of innovation. It's very difficult, and for larger companies to innovate. So I just started consulting on my own, and I kind of gravitated towards mergers and acquisitions. Also international commercialization. Helped one company. It was an Irish company, helped them find a distributor in Australia. So did some different activities like that as well. But overall, I just started to gravitate towards M&A because of my background and experience in M&A. But when you're at the Fortune 500 company, there's a team of people like myself working on an acquisition to go acquire another company. If you're a small entrepreneur of a business, either a startup business or even a $20 million a year company, you don't have somebody like Dave Shepard in business development or M&A on your team. And you usually only do something like this once, maybe twice in your life. So you don't have so much experience around how do you handle the negotiations, what's the right value. And so I kind of work as an outsourced business development person for M&A for these smaller companies. So when they get in conversations, whether it's a private equity firm or a strategic that wants to buy them, or maybe it's a competitor wants to buy them, I can help them understand how the process is going to work, what's the right value expectations that they should have. So make sure they're getting a good deal, helping them optimize. When I work with term sheets with larger companies, I understand some of the hooks that large companies try to put into deals with smaller companies. So I help them to try to negotiate those things away so that they can be protected in their small business. So that has expanded to meeting other people, including my co-founder and MedWorld Advisors. So we started that in 2015, formally as MedWorld Advisors. And now we have between 15 and 20 people around the world that collaborate with us on different projects, depending upon the project, where it's located, and that sort of thing.
Now, one of the prior guests on the show said, it was Tim Resendez, he's an attorney with a global law firm, and he says that companies will actually make acquisitions to enter a market. Is that the primary driver of what you're seeing with your clients, or is there another reason for doing the acquisitions?
Yeah, we have a saying at MedWorld Advisors that value equals strategic fit plus timing. And so that strategic fit can be around if a company maybe is looking to go into an adjacent space, that if you walk in after that board meeting where they've had that discussion about here's the markets we want to expand to something else. Now here comes MedWorld Advisors presenting our client that happens to be in that space. That's really a good fit. In fact, we're actually just received a term sheet for one of our clients in exactly that situation just this month. So it went to a company that is not in their core market, found out they were looking for an adjacent space. So that was great timing to meet them. So sometimes it can be around that. Sometimes it can be around customer acquisition. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's in the same space. However, they would like to grow their market share. And a great way to do that is to buy one of your competitors and be able to get more customers into that market segment that you can sell their products, but also expand your portfolio of products into. And sometimes it's just really around size and profits and being able to grow your company to be larger. When you scale a company to larger levels of performance, there are definitely financial rewards in our systems capitalist markets around the world, including in China. With Europe, US, and China, the bigger you are, often the larger the multiple is for the performance that you have, especially relative to profits.
Right, exactly. That makes sense. So expand geography, pick up new customers, or just to get bigger.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So say a company wants to go into China. You were talking some about how the laws and the regulatory environment was changing. How do you manage that if you're in a country or going into a country where you don't know what the game rules are?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so one thing I have learned is while often even the people in China, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes don't know the exact rules, if they've been there, they understand how to navigate the system so they can be able to take that to understanding with the regulators. And so it's often the best situation if you can have the right partner in a country like China to collaborate with, to work with. It comes with some pros and cons. The pros are in the market. They understand the market. There are some risks relative to the company maybe taking the regulatory approval and then owning that. And then if later on, if you want to sell your company, if the company in China owns your regulatory approval in China, then you have to get their permission to sell your own company. So you have to be very careful how you set up those kind of arrangements.
So tell me a little bit more about that. You partner with somebody to understand the system that's going on in the country, but then they file for the regulatory, so you don't actually own that.
Well, there's multiple ways to structure that. And so in some cases that's true. In some cases you can structure it so that they don't actually own. They're acting on your behalf. However, you have the rights to take it back. And so it's very delicate in those early negotiations, how you set up those contracts to make sure that you're protected for the future. And sometimes there is a little bit of maybe a penalty cost to be able to get it back. Because if you're the correct partner in China, to take the other side of it, if I'm going to go out and do all this work and get your product into the market in China, do all the translation, as you would know about, Wendy, because you have to do all of that. And in a country like China, it's not just one translation, as you probably know, it's many translations. So if I'm going to do all of that work for you to get your product in here, and then a year from now you want to sell your company, and the other company wants to take your product to somewhere else, and I've created the market for you, I want to be compensated something for that. So it's a give and a take, but both sides need to go in with transparency, understand those pros, those risks, and then capture that in such a way that's equitable for all parties.
So who's the best person to come up with that agreement? Is that you as an advisor? Is it the owner working with the partner? Do you bring lawyers in to negotiate that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the best way to get started in most situations, I learned really early on, one of my mentors relative to M&A was, it usually starts with relationships. And so you start a relationship between the business people and both companies, and so that you have an understanding, what are the business people on both companies trying to achieve? And so you have a framework of an understanding of how you want this engagement to work for both sides. And then once you have that understanding, then it's very important that you would have legal advice to make sure, relative to the country that you're operating in, that you have it structured in a way that meets the objectives of the business people that are involved. And both parties usually will have a lawyer involved on each side, just to make sure it's being equitable as mm-hmm. a good
board. Right. So lawyers, how would you, so you've built the relationship. I want to deep dive into both of those, relationships and lawyers. So I'll just start with the last one. How do you find a lawyer that could understand how to do something like that?
Well, in our case, we realized it was going to be very important, because in doing mergers and acquisitions, there's a lot of M&A advisors like ourselves that do that they sell businesses across industries. They might sell a restaurant one week, they might sell a medical device company next week. A lot of times they go through a formal investment banking training, that sort of thing. We are not investment bankers. We are really M&A advisors that came out of the Fortune 500 world. And our specific value proposition is the fact that we understand med tech and med device and digital health and those sort of things because of our experience. And so we focus only in the medical industry, which means if we're staying in one vertical segment, we have to have opportunities around the world to be able to participate in. So that's really kind of the niche that we play in. So we don't expand out. We just go and stay focused, but that could be working in medical in Hong Kong, or it could be Europe, or it could be US. So along those lines, in order to get deals done, we need to have access to, going back to your question about lawyers, to lawyers around the world. And so realizing this, we joined a group that's called IR Global, and it's a group of international lawyers and in some cases accountants that we have access to. So if we have a deal in Germany, we have a list of lawyers that we have actually met through in pre-COVID times. We've met at different events in Europe. We can find out who we work with. Who we work best with and who has certain skill sets that might be important for our clients. And we have those people in Europe, we have them in the US, we have them in Asia and in Hong Kong. So they collaborate with us on deals, which is very helpful.
Oh, okay. Now, in that, you've built relationships. So you started off talking about that you have to have the relationships when you start the negotiation process. You're building relationships that you'd be able to pull in. Relationships are very different around the world. Here, we're very transactional in the U.S., but in other places, you must have experienced differences. Can you talk about some of the relationship building experiences you've had?
Yeah, you're right, Wendy. Because as you go around the world, everybody has a different culture, of a different way of viewing relationships. And obviously, in Japan, it's a little bit different than it is in China. It's different than in the U.S. and then different countries in Europe. In Japan, it's interesting as you work with them, because you might be working with one person as your main point of contact. That you start to realize that person, no matter how good their business card might be, that one person is not making a decision. They're consensus oriented, so they're gonna make a team decision, and they're gonna take some time to make that team decision. So you have to have patience, and you have to understand that. And one of the early things that I learned about working in Japan is that when they say yes. They are not necessarily saying, yes, I agree. They are saying, yes, I hear you, what you're saying. And you probably know this from your experience working there.
Yes. Yeah.
And then you have to work out, how do you take the next step of commitment? Okay, so yes, we are agreeing that in October we want to do this. Yes, we have to start to narrow that down.
Okay, so yeah. So talk me through an example. Give me a story about when you heard a yes, and you thought it was a yes, and really it was an I heard you.
Yeah, so my first time was actually when I was still back in Tyco running a global business unit, and we were doing business in Japan. And so our team was working, engineering team was working with a supplier in Japan. And we were on conference calls with the supplier, and they kept saying yes, and they kept saying yes. So we kept thinking, okay, we're going to get what we're asking for tomorrow. We're going to get it for tomorrow. And finally, we talked to somebody on our side who was based in Japan, and they called up the supplier, and the supplier said, we never said, yes, we would do this tomorrow. We were just saying, yes, we understood what you're asking. So then we learned, okay, we have to ask the next level question after if you understand what we've asked. So that was very important. The other thing that I really learned in terms of negotiation style, while we're speaking about Japan, is, you know, in the U.S. it's all about win-win or negotiation to yes. In Japan, they don't like to say no. So it's very uncomfortable for them to say no. So it's really important that you understand that, so that you work with them and asking questions that make it easier for them to say yes than for them to have to say no. Because if they're having to say no, they go silent, because they're trying to figure out even how they would say that.
So you have to ask, rather than a yes or a no question, you might ask, so you would like to cancel this order? Yes, would be rather than would you like to, or, you know, would you like,
yeah,
to,
or, yes, or what, or no? What is the timing that you would like to receive this order, right? So then they might say, well, it's not possible for us to receive it until next year. So then you get the no, but they're telling you in a soft way, right?
Oh, so you're all saving face, because right, you didn't have to give that harsh answer. Yes.
Right.
So that's interesting about Japan. Any other advice for other countries that you've worked in?
Yeah, yes. Well, every country is a little bit different. And one thing to realize when you're working with other countries, and you've probably seen this one day with your business, is when people are translating and speaking in a second language, they tend to be a little more literal. And so when they're translating, they're kind of doing the literal translation. So you really have to understand that what they're actually meaning. And when you use things, when you're putting in other inflections relative to American culture, they may not understand it. So it's important that you're being clear and you're being direct, especially a country like Germany, for example, where there's a lot of good business, they call it the Mittelstand business in Germany, where, you know, Mittelstand is small and medium-sized businesses. It's really the backbone of, of the German economy, including in medtech and German.
Wait, it's called Mittelstand?
Yeah, Mittel, M-I-T-T-E-L, stand, Mittelstand.
Oh, interesting. So it's one word and it means like medium sized businesses, which is the backbone. Okay. I'm sorry. I just hadn't heard that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to study. So it's really, it really is the core of their economy. So they pay a lot of attention to making sure those businesses survive and thrive, actually. Just like in the US, the SBA tries to help small and medium sized businesses here. It's the same thing over there. So a lot of those companies, they want to be efficient. So it's a little different than Japan, where Japan, you have to get everybody involved. It takes a lot of time. In Germany, they want to be direct and they want to understand where you stand, where you are, and they want to know where they stand right all the time. And you have to be direct in your answers. They don't want to hear any kind of like trying to move. Sometimes in America, we try to move around an issue to get to a softer yes down the way. They don't want to hear that. They just want to know, are we moving forward or not, right? Not maybe because of this or that. They just want to know, are yes or no, right? kind of thing.
Oh, okay. So even more direct than Americans would be. Yes. All right. So you brought up translation. So tell me about how you did the communications. We'll start with the written communications. Is there a global English?
But you know, there is a quote unquote business English that's used, and you know, I would have to say that we're very fortunate as Americans and really spoiled when you travel around the world that the fact that business for the most part is done internationally as English as the primary language that's used in communication, right? So you know, I've learned a little bit of Spanish, I've learned a little bit of French, a little bit of German. However, I've never really ingrained it in me because every time I go to these countries, they just speak to me in English. And then unless you practice something, it's really hard to get that ingrained. So often they will speak in English, especially companies that have multinational businesses, international businesses. They will speak in English. They'll know English pretty well because they have to, because that's really the international business language. If it's just a regional company, like if it's just a company that in France, that just does business in France, they may only know French because they've never really had a need to even go to Germany and speak English to those people. Mm-hmm. But if they've done business in Germany, they may know German or they may know English. Just sometimes Germans and French communicate together in English, right? Because one knows German, one knows French, but they both know English as a backup, right?
Right. Okay, so a lot of times you're doing the communication, the talking in English. Did you ever work with an interpreter?
I have, but not frequently. More often in Japan and in China, especially in the earlier years of China, when people didn't really know. So you know, say 20 years ago, there definitely were some English educated people, business people, but it was less of them. Now it's becoming more prevalent. In fact, a whole generation has been raised, you know, because that's part of China's trying to get out and into the world and you know, trying to compete in the world, as they've taught their children the last generation, they've taught them English. But often, you know, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, not so many of them knew English, or even some of those people don't speak it on a regular basis. So while they might understand it a little bit, they like to have an interpreter, so they make sure they really understand what's being stated. And that's the same thing in Japan, because they even though they all often understand, they're very smart people, they understand English. Oftentimes they like things interpreted in order so that they can understand it. And one of my common business practices in working with in Japan, for example, is if I'm going to have a presentation there next week, whether it's going to be me visiting them or it's going to be on the phone, I will send them my presentation a week in advance. And same thing in China, so that they can actually have their people translate it. So they'll translate it from English to Japanese. So that way, when I make the presentation, they're actually looking at their Japanese version of my presentation.
That's interesting. So who do they have translate it?
They usually have somebody on staff to do that. Most companies will. And if they don't have somebody on staff, there'll be a service that can do that for them.
They'll have it done. And then you're trusting that the translation is saying what your presentation, the messaging you wanted to get.
Yeah, you're, Yeah, you're hoping.
Well, you know, we've translated presentations, and I remember one company told us that they were going over to conduct the meeting in Korea in English, and they were the only ones that translated their presentation, and they ended up winning because of that.
I believe, because they're understanding. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So, and you have to be careful when you, like you just were asking about translations. Like when I was at Tyco, we had somebody who was from the U.S. He actually moved to Japan. He had been there many years. He actually had learned Japanese. He previously had worked in GE in Japan, so he knew Japanese. And so he thought he knew it pretty well. And so he had his business card made up, and he was the head of the Asia Pacific region for Tyco. So he had his business cards made up. And whenever he handed them out, people would kind of give a little smile. And so finally he asked his administrative assistant, he said, how come people are smiling every time that they give them my business card? And she said, because your card says that you are the head of the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, that's priceless. And it was supposed to say head of Pacific region.
Correct.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, we translate business cards, and it's a process. You'd think, oh, it's just a short translation, but it's not. It's done. It's edited. It's sent over to back to the company. They have the person look at it if they're bilingual, and then they have somebody in country look at it. And then it comes back for, you know, if there's any edits for approval before it actually goes to print. So, and that's exactly why.
Yeah, it needs to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's your first image in. Right. So, yeah, so that's really interesting to hear that you would send your translation off to be translated, and then it is kind of a crossing your fingers to hope that it's good. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now when I was at the big company, of course, we would have our local people translate it, right? So, and of course, and since I started MedWorld, I actually just met you, so I'm thinking now as I'm speaking with you, when next time I go to Japan, I might have you translate it before I send it over.
And we're happy to do it, you know. That's that. Then you know that the message is accurate and it's coming across.
Yes, very, very, very important. And it makes sense because it's just more comfortable for them to understand things in their language, even though they do understand English. But they don't have the intimate knowledge of it like they do their own natural language.
Right, right. And translators are professionally trained. I mean, there are schools and colleges, and there are people that go there for years, and they specialize in certain industries. And so, you know, we've run into that where people have done it, you know, with somebody internal, and it misses the complete meaning.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So this is your communications when you're working in M&A and, you know, business growth and everything, and you're working with medical device. So there is also language work that is needed when it's going out to the consumer, or to the final user, instructions for use or packaging or CE marks. How is that typically handled?
Yes. So in the cases where you work with, maybe earlier stage companies, sometimes before they're ready to sell their company or sell their technology, we'll help them think about their international presence so they can be more scalable for whoever might acquire them in the future. And so then that's when we start to think about those kind of issues. Okay, so what countries are you in now? What countries would you like to be in? How are we going to do that? What are the regulatory clearances need to take place? What are the translations that are going to need to be made? You know, one thing that you and I, Wendy, talked about in our last conversation, that often inexperienced business people, as far as international are concerned, they're coming from the U.S., they look at Europe, and they go, great, that's a nice market opportunity in Europe. I'm going to go launch in Europe. And as soon as they say I'm going to launch in Europe, I start to have a question mark in my mind. Do we need to define Europe a little bit? Because yes, they're correct, they're going to launch in Europe. However, there's 28, 29 countries, depending upon who's in there or who's exiting at the moment, but 28 or 29. Nine countries there that they are all have their own regulations. They have their own translations, their own requirements, and it's very difficult for someone to be successful to launch and have a European strategy to launch. You usually have to have a we used to have it at Covidien, we used to have a big five strategies to start there and then expand out into the other countries. You know, so work with the UK when it was in, you know, Germany, France, Spain, and Italy, and be able to make sure that you could win in those countries. And of course, that meant in you know, UK is a little bit easier because it's English, but there is a little bit of variations in English. But then France, you got to make sure it's in French and you understand the cultural differences when you're marketing the product. Same thing in Germany. And then usually if you can win in Germany, then you can expand that into Switzerland and Austria. So you can kind of start to branch out, you know, that way. And then Spain and Italy have their own culture as well. And the big thing in those countries, usually you have to be prepared for is you have to have a really good cash flow, because in Spain and Italy, they're just not going to pay you for a while. They usually pay you, but it usually takes a little bit longer there.
Oh, okay. And when you were in the large company, how did you end up handling translations there?
We usually had our own team because we had people, we had local people in each region. Yeah. So when you're, you know, when you get to be a multi-billion dollar company, you have people in each region that could take the American made marketing brochure or whatever and put it into the local. And if it was expanding to a country that we didn't have anybody with, then we usually would use a distributor to translate it for us, or go to a service like you to translate it.
So now if somebody gets a Spanish translation because they're launching in the big five and then in Europe, and then they decide to go to South America, did you find, you know, like Covidien was using, again, it was all done in the market, or would they globalize and use one translation so the messaging stayed consistent?
Yeah, that was always a delicate balance, because you know, you have a global marketing group that wants to make sure the message stays consistent. However, as you know from your experience, that you know, in Portugal there's Portuguese, in Brazil there's Portuguese. However, the cultures in Portugal and Brazil are completely different. So you do have to make
language. That's why right. It's Spanish, not Portuguese. But, right. But go ahead. Yeah,
but same thing. Well, in Spanish, while the language may be similar, the cultural differences between Argentina and Spain are different. And so you still have to make sure that the messaging is appropriate for the culture. So you may be saying the same translation and maybe it literally is okay, but maybe message wise in that culture, it may not be appropriate. And so therefore you have to have a local look at it.
Okay. All right. So that, yeah, you have to have a local look at it for actually going out, but, all right. So what I was wondering about is like in the Spanish, some companies, what I see is they'll send it to their local market and they lose the messaging, but then they also have the expense for all those people doing the translation. So, you know, but that's quite common because of how marketing is, you know, when they need to adapt it to the local market, but it's not leveraging the strengths of being a global company. So I was wondering how much you were seeing that.
Yeah, you really do have to. I mean, there's this old saying about you have to think strategically globally, but you have to execute tactically locally. That in translation, I think that's really true. I think you can use a translation service like yourself and have an excellent job. However, before you launch it, you need to have some local input to make sure. So even though you've done an excellent job of translating it, you just have to make sure there's no message in there that is going to offend somebody in that particular culture.
Right. What about machine translation and automated translation? Have you run into that at all?
You know, that's above my pay grade right now. I know it's happening. I have not had much experience of that at this point. Is that something that's taken place much relative to what you're doing?
No, we don't. We've stayed all in high quality translations. There's some specific use cases for it. And so I was just wondering if you'd run into that. But you're talking about all high quality, culturally adapted translation. That's what we do. So, but I was just curious if you'd come across that at all and what you would run into.
Yeah, I think in this industry, it's just critical to have somebody like yourself has some intelligence, applied intelligence, to what's going out there, because it's not only just you know, literal translation of the language, but it's also understanding the medical terms that are involved relative to the value proposition of somebody's product and technology. And those are things I would not trust to a machine.
Right. Right. Yeah. A machine can't pick up on that and the differences with each individual market. So, yeah. How do you think different cultures influence people's purchasing decisions?
That certainly is an issue and has an impact. So that's a great question. Obviously, in different cultures, it's part of their culture of behavior. It's also the culture of their economics that they have can make a difference as far as their purchasing decision points. And in some cases, you can have multiple tiers of culture. You know, for example, in China, in the medical system, they have three tiers over there. And so commonly we would address as far as, okay, we're going to bring out a new product. Are we going to bring it out for the first tier, the second tier, the third tier? Because there are different price points for each. So the first tier in China is the highest level. This is what the government in Beijing, when their hospital and their military people get to use and all that. And that's where they'll buy. They won't buy, interestingly enough, for high quality Chinese government officials and high level business people, they won't buy Chinese products. They'll buy Siemens and they'll buy Philips and they'll buy GE. They'll buy American branded or German branded products because they know that they can trust it. And then when it gets down to the second tier, I feel like the middle class, then it'll be a mix of both Western and Chinese companies. And then the third tier, just like your average clinic and that sort of thing, it'll be all Chinese products because it's just as cheap as you can get.
I'm trying to pick my chin up off the ground. I didn't not realize that. And that's medical delivery, is it's tiered out as to what class you're in.
Yeah, that is correct. So strategies literally done by global companies, not only for China, but the different tiers within China. And the same thing in India, by the way.
And is India on income level or is it on caste?
Well, the strategy is around the income level, but then of course some of your marketing might be around the messaging to the caste, right?
So tell me more about that.
So in India, you have the government hospitals and then you have the private hospitals. And maybe obvious to say that in the private hospitals, not many of the average Indians can actually afford them. It has to be more of a middle class and there's different levels of private hospital. So some of them will market to the middle class because that's how they're expanding their base. And there's a growing middle class in these countries like China and India so they can afford to pay cash. And then there's the higher level hospitals that, you really need to be of someone of certain status and income to be able to go to those hospitals because of the caste system that they have.
Wow. Okay. Well, I say that, but then you look in the United States and ours is defined on income level. You've got the same thing going in and you might have city versus rural too. And so it's more geographic.
Yeah. And unfortunately, COVID has magnified that situation for people that have access. And I think the major issue that we've had, regardless of your political side of things, is access to care. And Obamacare was one attempt to address it. Rightly or wrongly, at least it did attempt it. There's obviously lots of ways that can be improved. But we need to find a way to make sure there's access to care in terms of people being able to walk into a facility so that they know there's going to be a reimbursement in some way. So if somebody's not putting off a life, something that could be life threatening, not putting off care for themselves. In other cases, access to care, like what you just said, the rural hospitals, they've been closing the last 10 years. People may have to drive hundreds of miles just to find medical care. And then that obviously in somebody in an urgent situation can really be a challenge. And those kind of things, those things happen in other countries too. You get into rural areas and poor areas, and even in China or India, maybe Latin America, they might have some kind of clinic out in the rural area, but they don't really have a high grade hospital in some cases.
So, if you out of all the insurance or medical access to care, I guess I should call it, in the whole world, what country do you think does the best at it?
You know, I'm not an expert in this area, but just anecdotally from what I've seen, and I also have I've ran business groups internationally. I have a greenfield in operation in Shenzhen in China one time, and so I have a team there. I have people in Germany. I have collaborated with a business in France. The one I've seen that's done the best is, in my opinion, is Germany. They balanced it pretty well. So they have a government system, but they also have a private option. And so yes, it does lend itself that people that are working, they do make more money and they can get better care. So nothing's ever 100% equitable. At the same time, they make sure that even if you are not working, don't have any income, you're going to have access to care no matter what. And then if you are working and you're willing to pay a little bit, you can have access to a little better care. It seems like everybody's covered in somewhat of a balanced way. So I like their system kind of as a model and on several levels, actually.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah, because they're large enough and then they've built the efficiencies into it. So that's good to know. All right. For companies that are going international, what do you think are the biggest risks? And we'll talk about it in your area, medical device and everything but pure drug play development, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the biggest risk usually are around two things. One is the regulatory clearance, and then the other one is around the reimbursement model for their products. So they're often companies get started with a nice technology, innovative. Hopefully it's meeting a unmet clinical need, because then you have a better chance to win if you're actually solving a real problem. I've seen where people have a nice technology in one area that's not medical and they try to put it into medical just because it's a great technology, unless you've actually identified a problem that you're solving, it usually doesn't work so well. But assuming that you've got something that's innovative relative to an unmet clinical need, the biggest challenge is, have you understood the regulatory clearances appropriately and the risk relative to the pathway to get the clearance to be in the market? And then secondly is, do you understand what the reimbursement is going to be once you get there? Because a lot of people understand the first, but they haven't thought through the second. And the worst thing is to be on the market and realize nobody's buying your product because they can't afford it. So it may be the greatest invention, for wound care that's ever taken place. But if nobody can afford to buy it, they're going to just keep using what they're currently doing, because maybe they're not getting reimbursed for it by the government because the government doesn't recognize your product because you haven't taken the steps to get it validated from an economic perspective. So if the current Band-Aid costs 10 cents and yours costs $10, and they, it's a little bit better, but we're not going to pay for it until you prove to me that actually I'm going to save money by using your $10 item instead of the 10 cent thing. And there's ways to do that, but you have to make sure that happens. Otherwise, you're going to sit there on the shelf, or you may not even get on the shelf.
So a company really could start going international by getting those things done and then launching.
Yeah, that's correct. And then, of course, taking care of the tactical execution points. Like we've been talking about, doing the translation, making sure that you have the IFUs in the different languages in the country. And sometimes that's one additional language in the country. Sometimes there's multiple languages that are used in certain countries.
Right. What would be your top recommendations for somebody that wanted to start doing this?
As far as expanding from the U.S. and going international?
Yes.
Yeah. It's interesting right now, because I used to say Europe because the CE mark was relatively inexpensive, and from time to market standpoint, pretty efficient to be able to get to market. They're, as you may know, they're changing that now, but changing the regulations, and they actually are becoming more difficult to work with than the US FDA. In fact, the FDA in the last 10 years has gotten better, and the CE mark in Europe has gotten more challenging. Through the process that they're deploying. So going from America, Europe is a big market, so it's hard to ignore. You just can't get there as fast as you'd like to. So maybe what you might want to do is think about, it depends on how much resource that you have. If you're a smaller company, you might want to think about the Middle East to go to first, because we often found when I was at Covidien that the Middle East could be a nice proving ground for innovation. They love American technology. Their regulatory clearance is not really too challenging as long as it's been FDA approved. Distributors there are looking for FDA approved products to be able to sell to some of these hospitals, and they have a lot of money over there. So you can generate some cash flow from that to be, and also to be able to prove that you can do something international. You know, and then you've frankly taken a flight on Emirates or one of these, you know, these Arab airlines. It's not a bad thing. Those they do it pretty well.
They do nice on Emirates. Yeah. What is there specific countries in the Middle East or?
Yeah. UAE. You know, even Saudi Arabia is also a good country. You have to be a little more careful in Saudi Arabia relative to the cultural issues. You can't have a drink of alcohol while you're there. There's places you can, but I would just advise don't think about it. Just go and do your business. Be very careful about, you know, mind your P's and Q's. Get some advice from what you should and shouldn't do, and then get a good distributor. And then as soon as you get a good distributor, let them manage it, and then make sure you're managing that distributor. That's really the key to success internationally. If you don't have a direct sales team, is how you manage your distributor to make sure you're getting their time, and so that you're getting some of their selling time relative to your product. So that's key.
So tell me more about that. How would you work with a distributor and make sure you're getting what you want?
Yeah, so that starts from the beginning. You know, so anytime, I always tell people, when you're thinking about putting together an agreement, always think about have the end in mind when you start. So think about what your objectives are, and then once you agree on the objectives, then you start to break it down. Okay, so what do we have to do to manage to be able to achieve these objectives together, and then actually spell those things out and understand who's accountable for what in the relationship. What is the distributor accountable for? What am I as a manufacturer accountable for? And we hold each other accountable to make sure that we're doing these things. And it should be on both sides. It should be transparent. It should be at a minimum a quarterly meeting to review these things. If you're first getting started, you might want to be doing that on a monthly basis just to make sure that everything's going in the right direction. And then also in early selling time, you might want to go spend some time and actually go do some co-selling with them just to make sure they're comfortable with the message and being able to answer the objections that come up with the clinicians.
And I've heard with picking a distributor, you can go where you'd be the big product and you might get more attention versus picking a distributor that's going to have similar products, and then being careful of going with one that has a bunch of other products and yours could get lost in the mix. What do you recommend for picking a distributor?
Yeah, if you've already established a pretty good market share, you know, then going with a distributor like Owens & Minor or Cardinal or Henry Schein, you know, that these kind of companies can be very good for you because it provides more access for your customers to be able to get your product into your distribution pathway. However, if you're a new innovative product and you need your distributor to actually sell something for you, those are not the kind of companies you want to work with, because they are not selling. They are just essentially, they're doing what their nomenclature says, they're distributing. So what you really need is a distributor who, in most cases, that is very specialized to your market segment, knows the key clinicians in your market segment. For example, if you're launching an orthopedic product, you may want to get to a distributor that has relationships with key orthopedic surgeons in that particular country. And that's going to help you to be able to make sure you get introduced your innovation to those surgeons and be able to get your product in the door through those relationships they have. If you don't have somebody actually taking the time to sell your technology, understand your value proposition, and translate that to the clinician in wherever country they might be, then you're going to have challenge to ever be tried. I've seen this happen where somebody's got a really nice distributor order in 2018, and then 2019 they had no sales in a certain country. What happened? They got a nice stocking order from the distributor, and then the distributor got busy, distracted. They weren't managed well, and they never reordered.
So that's why you recommend the monthly or the quarterly meetings, because you're selling to them. You're keeping front of mind.
Right, because they have other things to sell usually as well. And the easier you can make it that for them to sell, the better chance you have for success. So the more you can just make it simple for them and specifically for their salespeople, the more you can incentivize them, and the more you can make it just simple for them, the better chance you're going to have to succeed. Salespeople, while they're very aggressive, they work hard. However, when it actually comes to a sales process, a lot of them are lazy. They'll take the easiest path to a sale. So they want to make money. And if selling your product's the easiest way to make money, they're going to do it. If selling somebody else's product's the easiest way to make money, they're going to do that and maybe spend less time on yours. So you have to make it easy for them so that they understand it. They can turn over the product quickly and they can be incentivized in the right way. So you have to think about the whole package.
So what about having your distributor do your translation? Has that worked before? I see lots of issues with that. And so I'm curious as to your experience.
It's not my preference. I've seen it happen and it can work. And my preference is to have the translation controlled at the corporate level, working with somebody like yourself, and then send it to the distributor to put any cultural inputs into it. You know, for example, like, I can't remember which country, but you know, one country, either purple is an issue, right? So if you had, purple in your brochure, even though your messaging was fine, you may not want to put purple, you know, in it. So you get that kind of feedback back, so you can change the color, because that's not really a big deal if you want to see in that country. I'd be happy to change it from purple to green to make sure I'm going to win.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's a great idea. Well, we're getting close to run out of time, and I wanted to ask you some personal questions and have a little bit of fun here. So how about your favorite foreign word? I like to start that at the beginning and forgot to ask you. So we'll
go from there. My favorite foreign word is obrigado.
Oh, nice. And what does that mean?
So obrigado is it's thank you in Portuguese and mostly in Brazil, right? Obrigado, right?
Yeah.
And when that became my favorite word is actually when I traveled to Brazil, because they say it, you know, people down there are so friendly and they say it with such enthusiasm, and so it just kind of stuck with me. So it took me a second to come back because I haven't been there for a while, but that really is my favorite word. In Japan, just because I took the time to learn it, so it was just fun for me. Ohayou gozaimasu. It's a greeting. It's only used once in the day. So it's the first time I see you today, I would say ohayou gozaimasu.
Oh, that's great. Great. So you'd never say that again, like we use how you doing all the time. Ohayou gozaimasu is the first greeting. Yeah. How about your favorite vacation?
Favorite vacation, you know, it's funny. I've traveled the world and I love a lot of places internationally. However, my favorite place is Hawaii.
Oh, nice. Which island?
Maui is the favorite. There's not a bad island, but however, Maui is the favorite because it's just probably the most relaxing. It's for me, it's just one of the most relaxing places in the world. And even though I love Singapore, Singapore is so hot and humid. Hawaii, while it is hot, a little bit humid, it's not the same. It's not that level at all. So it's just almost perfect weather almost every single day. It's pretty hard. I mean, you can throw a rock and you can find a beach, right? So it's really just a nice environment. And it's just a little bit, you know, more, I think what they call it, island time. So just more relaxed pace.
Gosh, that sounds delightful right now. I'd love to go.
Especially with winter coming soon.
Yeah. How about your most memorable cross-cultural experience?
I think there's been many, but I would say one of them was the first time I did a major presentation in China. It was in Shenzhen, China, which is just right across the border from Hong Kong. Uh-huh. And we were working with a local Chinese company in terms of a license agreement for our technology. And then they sold their company to Philips. And so they were having a major transition of the from Philips to the factory, from the ownership from the current Chinese company to Philips. This may be 15, 16 years ago, I guess. And so they had local dignitaries there. And so because we had a big partnership with this local Chinese company, I was asked to speak at the event. But of course I had to send my speech in advance to the personnel in the Chinese company so they could have it reviewed by the local government officials. So I'd never had my speech reviewed by anyone before like that. So it had to be approved. And a lot of times I like to say at the end of a speech, you know, may God bless you. And I wasn't sure if I should include that in or not, but you know what? I thought, just for entertainment, I'll see if they approve that or not. They were fine, you know. So I didn't get any specific ideology. I just said, "May God bless you" at the end. But anyway, so then I got to the event, and as typical, events go long, and so there was a lot of government officials speaking and on and on and on, and then the Philips people were speaking on and on and on, and they were translating everybody that was speaking for the local, because the Chinese people there in the factory, none of them spoke English,
right?
And so And this is a big party, there's food, there's drink, but they couldn't really start the food and drink until all the speaking was done. And I was the last speaker.
So they
had been telling me, they'd been prepping me how to work with my translator, how they're gonna interpreter, I'm gonna speak, whatever. Yeah. I got up there and they say, "We're running out of time, Dave. We're not gonna translate you, just go."
So you're talking to a group of Chinese people that don't speak English and they weren't gonna have an interpreter for you?
So I'm just standing up there in this group. There's probably about 3,000 Chinese people that I don't know. They don't know me. And I'm speaking my speech in English. I think I remembered a few Chinese words to greet them with, which I got smiles out of. And after that, they had no idea what I was saying. And then at first I was a little bit appalled by it, but then I actually just became kind of amused that I'm just speaking to all these people. I could be telling about my cousin back in Idaho. They really wouldn't care. They wouldn't know. The only interesting part was I did happen, because I have a great relationship with Phillips over the years, I did happen to know the head guy at Phillips who was at one of the tables, and he's looking at me, and they hadn't told him that they weren't translating me. So he's looking at me like, "Shepherd, are you an idiot? Because you're not waiting for your translator, right?"
Oh, what a horrible situation to be in.
So I just made the best of it and just turned into being amusing. And then when I explained to him later on, we just both laughed about it.
So I have a business school classmate, Gary Giles, who was presenting in Japan, and he called us up and he says, "Look, I want you to translate my speech into Japanese, but I don't want it in Japanese characters. I want it all phonetic so I can just read the sounds to me, but it'll have the message come across." So we were like, "Sure, I guess we can do that." And he said it went over very, very well. They were shocked. And then I'm surprised that for a group that size, they didn't have simultaneous interpreting to shorten the time, because that would have been them talking the same time you are, to not drag the whole evening out on something like that.
Right. I've been to many of those events over in Europe where I'm speaking and there's simultaneous translation going on, like the UN, right, where somebody's translated in Italian, French, for our international sales teams, right, when we had sales events, right? So that's very efficient and it makes a lot of sense, right?
Right, and we've seen a huge switch to now the online conferences wanting to have the simultaneous interpreters on there. So we've been scrambling to get the interpreters trained on this technology so they can make it work. Yeah. So have you lived in any of the other countries?
I have traveled to them many times, but I have never lived in any of the other countries. I usually had this situation where I was a global business leader, so I would have to spend a week or two in Europe, and then I'd be off a week or two in Asia and do that every quarter back. And so I traveled 200,000 miles a year, but never too long in one place.
Oh my gosh. So you really racked up those frequent flyer miles.
Yeah. Almost 3 million on United right now.
And you can't fly. Ouch. All right. Well, David, this has been fabulous having you here. If somebody wants to reach you, what's the best way to find you?
Best way to find us is at MedWorld Advisors, www.medworldadvisors.com. And my email is daveshepherd@medworldadvisors.com.
Okay, you want to spell that for me, please?
Yes. So MedWorld Advisors is Med, M-E-D, mm-hmm. World, and then Advisors. And it's all one word. So MedWorld Advisors, and Advisors with an O, at advisors.com, www.medworldadvisors.com.
And Dave Shepherd, S-H-E-P-P-A-R-D?
Yes, Wendy, that's great.
Yeah, Dave Shepherd. Advisors.com. Yes. Good. Okay, well, everybody, thank you for listening. If you learned something today or you had a laugh, tell somebody about the podcast. We'd love to have new listeners. You can find us on all your favorite places to listen. We'll talk to you next time.
Wendy, thank you for having me. Have a great day.
All right, thanks. You too, David.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.